Hi, my name is Roy Collin, and welcome to the show. I've also got Fight Podcast, The Awakening Podcast, Exposing Fraud and Corruption, but with Solutions, the Crypto Podcast, talking about all things blockchain, NFTs, crypto, the Meditation Podcast, talking about all different types of meditation, but there's also meditations there from 1 minute to 2 hours. And the other one's the Learn Polish Podcast, so if you're interested in learning Polish, you can do that. And the other one is Speaking with Roy Collin. And I just have guests from around the world talking about either public speaking or also about their book or just general life in general. And you find everything on bio.link/podcaster. I'm also a podcasting coach. And you see the QR code there. And it's also on my link as well. And if you're interested in actually going on some podcast shows, I'm helping people doing that. Or if you're interested in sponsorship, you can contact me. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, danielpacker.com. He helps people with anxiety, stress, and addictions. He's got a 90% success rate, and you only pay if you're successful. So be sure to check him out, danielpacker.com. I hope you enjoy this week's show. Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You'll find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. My guest today, he's an author, inventor, physician, scientist, entrepreneur, keynote speaker, born in Mumbai. He's the founding physician and president of the Ivor Clinic LMG in Fairfax and Loudoun, County, Virginia, USA, and serves as the director of clinical research for Loudoun Medical Group. A physician, scientist, inventor, and entrepreneur with research publications in the mechanisms of gene controls and several patents on human and veterinary medicines and devices. Dr. Ivor has been listed on the Who's Who in America and serves as the CEO of Active Power, a nutrition and wellness company he founded. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Ravi Ivor.
Hello, Ryan. This is a pleasure, Mr. Coughlin, and look forward to talking with you about, I believe we are talking about speaking.
I think just in general, it's like more conversation. But what the first thing that I would like to say is I've done over 1,200 podcasts, and you're the first person that actually sent the form that I have and explained how to pronounce your name, because there's a lot of times I'd be practicing it or I'd listen to it and I'd hear different versions, and that actually helps. So I'm actually going to change my forms to ask people to give it the pronunciation. So first of all, thanks very much for doing that. It actually helps a lot.
Yeah. My last name, people get it all kinds of ways. It's understandable. It's spelled as I-Y-E-R, and it's pronounced as higher, and just like higher, like I, like an I and a year, it's easy. But once you get it, otherwise I had all kinds of pronunciations.
So there's one thing I just want to touch on before I go into your qualifications, because you've done some massive studies. When somebody does a PhD, they're known as a doctor. And unfortunately, the brain kind of, when somebody says doctor this, you just assume they're actually a medical doctor. Does that actually bother doctors, the way that was actually done?
Not to me. I'm both. I did a MD medicine as well as I did a doctoral degree. So I did both. I have a joke about it. I say that I really wasn't a very good student. I could not graduate. I kept going on and on and on.
So you might touch on your qualification, because like was it Harvard? I have it, you've done so much study. So like, just to let people know, so they know the extent of what you've done.
So I started out as being a physician. I got my physician's degree 40 years ago in 1983, January. It's almost going to be 41 years and another month and a month and a quarter. So, then after I got my physician's degree, I was treating patients in India, and I was frustrated by not having the resources to treat them. So I had the knowledge to diagnose the condition. And then I would say, well, I don't have the medicine for you. So you know, you're going to have to suffer or die or whatever. But I know what you got, but I can't fix it. So I was frustrated with that. So I decided to give up medicine and go into basic science. And I was working on how the body fights leprosy and tuberculosis. I was looking at the immunological mechanisms by which the human body fights disease. And I did my doctoral degree in that. And then from there, I went to Harvard to continue as a postdoctoral fellow. I was a research fellow in medicine at Harvard Med School and at MGH Cancer Center. And went from there to a second postdoctoral fellowship at Children's Hospital in Dana-Farber, continuing the same kind of work, but going deeper and deeper and more sophisticated, went into the genetic control mechanisms of all of that. And all of that ended up, I got a Young Investigator Award, and I went to DC to receive the award. And I happened to meet the program director for the medical residency program at George Washington at that ceremony. And then he offered me a position as a resident. And I took that up. I switched from Harvard. I moved to George Washington University Medical Center in Washington, D.C. to do my residency, and I got a physician's license. And then during that period, I spent some time at a clinic in Northern Virginia. I really liked it. So I decided to take another switch. I moved into direct patient care, but I wanted to continue my hands in research. So I did something that was not very common at that time. People always used to think that you had to, if you were doing private practice in the community, you could only see that. If you want to do research and you want to do academics, then you had to be at a university. And I said, why do I have to do that? I want to do private practice, but I want to do research. So I want to do private practice in and research clinical trials in a community center. So I created the Iyer Clinic, and we saw patients, and we also did clinical trials in the clinic, which is pretty unique. Even to this day, I'm part of a 300 physician group, and I'm the only practice that does patient care and clinical trials. Most of the other doctors are not able to do that. And so right from childhood, I have had this flexibility in my mind. I can, when I do something, I'm all in it. And when I want to change, I change, and I change without any residue, without any regret, without any hangover. And I do something new with full attention there. And I've always been able to be satisfied and happy in whatever I do. It doesn't matter which field. I don't spend my time looking at, oh, I did. So this flexibility of adaptability, as you want to call it, is something that I was born with, and it has helped me very well.
Excellent. So with like the wellness side of things, because it's something that over the years I've kind of researched and spoke to people, the kind of natural remedies that a lot of doctors are kind of taught in the West tends to be they might get an hour or half an hour. I think Albania was the best one that I came across, but I'm from India then. Do they try to put is it more both that you're getting the best of both worlds, whatever's going to give you, make you recover.
In my clinic, we combine both. And that's because I grew up in India. And I grew up where in India, herbal medicine and natural products of nature used in everyday health and wellness is part and parcel of everyday life. I never went to a college or studied how to create herbal medicines. I just learned it with my father and my mother and my grandmother in my house. And later, when I went into Western medicine, I learned all the technology of Western science, which is a different approach to the same thing. But from a different angle. So now when I practice, I combine the best of both and I change. With some patients, I will say, you know, you need to use this. Or some patients, I'll say, no, you need a prescription and a pill. So I can adapt, and I do not see these two sides as conflicting, because essentially everything is chemistry, everything is molecules, everything is, whether it is coming from a plant or whether it's coming from a synthetic created product, it is still chemistry. The only difference in a plant, it's a complex chemistry because it is not a single molecule. It's usually multiple compounds are present in the same leaf or in the same root or in the same seed. Whereas in this, conventional Western pharmacology, you have a purified compound, a single compound. And that is because Western medicine, the business of Western medicine, does not allow you to get a profit by using a natural product. You can't patent a natural product. So to patent something, you have to purify it and you have to isolate it and make a single compound. And then you have to synthesize it artificially rather than extract it out of something. So those are the things that prevent so it is the business model of profiting from the knowledge that dictates how it is being done. But it is not necessarily fundamentally a problem of the chemistry itself.
And does it frustrate you that more doctors aren't doing what you're doing? Because at the end of the day, it should be to kind of help your patients. But I mean, I've talked about in my Awakening podcast about the kickbacks and stuff like that. And there's no kind of, the pharma companies have no accountability if anything goes wrong as well. They're kind of protected.
Business is business. Business people are operating on only two principles. One is the creation of wealth and the consolidation of power. That is the nature of business. I don't say that is wrong or good. I just recognize it. Like, there's nothing wrong about a snake being a snake, right? It is the nature of a snake. That is all. You just recognize it and learn how to work with it. You learn how to move around. And if you want to be a very ethical about it, then you be ethical on your grounds, but don't ever forget that the snake is a snake. So that's how I live my life. I am not frustrated that other doctors you can't be what you don't know. I spent 5 years becoming a physician. I spent 3 years in training before I went into a doctoral degree. I spent 10 years in research. I spent another 3 years in training to get a license as a physician in the US. So you total that up. And if you have not spent that many years, how are you going to command knowledge on both sides? So, the other doctors are not able to do it because they have not spent that many years. I have spent that many years, and therefore I'm able to do it. So I don't feel frustrated that I am unique. I am unique. I don't want to pretend that I am just ordinary. There's no false modesty about this. A diamond is a diamond, gold is gold, iron is iron. That's just the fact of it. There's nothing good or bad about it. If an iron wants to become gold or diamond, then it has to go and do the necessary work to become gold and diamond. That's all.
And because I've got neuropathic doctor friends, and I spoke to loads on the show, the other show. And the censorship has gone through the roof, especially in the last few years. And I'm just curious, did you experience any of that with what you're doing? Because you're kind of doing both.
Yeah. There is. So whenever you have an idea, initially an idea, if the idea is unique, if it is if the concept is unique, then there is going to be resistance, because that idea is going to threaten whatever was the prevailing ideas that existed in society before. For example, the idea at the time of Christopher Columbus was that the world was flat. And Christopher Columbus came around and said, no, the world is not flat. I believe it is round, because there's somebody called Copernicus and Galileo who say that it's probably round. So I think I'm going to follow them. And he could not get any people to fund his expedition. Nobody was willing to fund Christopher Columbus's ship or his crew. And it was only, and he had to fight with for his idea. And it was only when he went to Queen Isabella and said that, you know, there's a lot of wealth in the foreign country. I believe that there is a lot of lands that you can get and, you know, things like that. I'm going to find a different route. Portugal has blocked all the routes to India where all the spices are. And I want to find a different way to get there. So Spain has to go the other way around the world to reach India. And that was the goal. So he had to fight. So did he feel suppression? Yes, there was going to be suppression. And you have to use all kinds of methods to promote your idea and to promote and to get some people to buy into that. You show value for your idea. You show, just like Christopher Columbus, he tried to get Isabella to believe that there's value. Her value was gold and land. So, and some way of getting around the Portuguese man of wars. So he sold her on that value. So like that, when I came about to talk about what I wanted to do, whether it was the concept of medicine or practicing medicine slightly differently, bringing diverse fields into my clinic for the benefit. There are two agencies in front of me. One is the patient who was immediately getting value. And then the other people, the competing physicians around me who look at me and say, hey, maybe this guy is going to be a threat to me. And so can I shut him down? And so on and so forth. And you prevent that by becoming so good at what you do that the patients vote for you. And when they vote for you, they can't ignore you anymore. And that's basically what I did.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. I heard you on another show just talking about how you kind of got into becoming a doctor. You were talking about your grandfather. You might kind of tell that story.
Oh, actually, my grandfather, he, when I was a small boy, my grandfather, this is my paternal grandfather. My paternal grandfather became a monk and spent the last 26 years of his life in a monastery. And while he was there, towards the end of his life, he had a stroke and he was bedridden and he could not get up. And so I was an 8-year-old boy at that time, and I visited him because my parents said, you know, Nana is sick and we may not get a chance, so let's go and see Grandpa. So we went to the monastery and we spent time with him. And so as an 8-year-old boy, I had read this book about how somebody had gotten better from stroke and regained their hand, use of their hand and leg through therapy and rehab. So I was convinced that my grandfather could also lift his leg and move and not be bedridden. And I kept pushing him and I said, no, you can do it. Come on, focus on your mind, put your mind there, move that toe of yours, you know, things like that. And he could not. And So then I left the room, and then after some time I was coming back, and I was standing at the doorway, and he didn't see me, and he was telling my mom, and he said, "Poor Ravi, he wants so badly for me to get up and play with him, and this old body simply cannot." And suddenly I realized in his voice the immense regret he had that he was not able to participate with me in my life. And I felt really bad that I made him feel bad. And at that point, that was the point when I was 8 years old that I decided that I'm going to be a doctor. Because from that point onwards, I wanted to, my life has been about what makes life work. And when life does not work, then how do you make it work? So my entire life has been about that. When a patient comes to me, that's all they have. They are not looking for a diagnosis. A patient comes to me, they are saying, "Doc, I am having a problem that is preventing me from living life the way I would like to live it. And all I do is either I make the problem go away, or I try to reduce the impact of the problem, make it less. Or if I can't do those two, then I teach him how to live with it and still live life despite the problem." That's the only three things I do. And to do that, I bring all the things in my life, all the methodologies, the knowledge, the words, the ability to empower through speech, through encouragement, through wisdom, through knowledge of chemistry, through knowledge of herbal medicine, through knowledge of Western medicine. I bring my network of other consultants, other specialists who are skilled at all of what they do. And I bring them all for the benefit of this one person and the problem that is preventing him from living life. That's all I do. So fundamentally, that's all life is. Life is nothing but a journey of empowerment. You empower people, and in this process, you get empowered yourself.
So this beautiful book that I can see in the background, The Reaper's Dance, you might let people know what exactly you're covering in that.
Well, The Reaper's Dance came out of something that we did during the COVID pandemic. During the COVID pandemic, see, 40 years of my life has been about empowerment and about making people realize that they are not the victim of their circumstances. That whatever life throws at them, they can rise above and go beyond it. When the pandemic came, that pandemic, it blasted the whole world apart into and through everyone, not just the people in my clinic, but the whole world was thrown into this pit of fear, of complete powerlessness, where even the breath you take can be something lethal, where human connection, where 3 feet, you can't sit 3 feet face to face and have a cup of coffee. So the common acts that we do for connection, a little hug, a kiss, a small gathering of friends, all of that was dangerous. So the fabric of humanity started falling apart, and I suddenly realized that this thing is not about the virus. It is the fear is the real virus. The fear is the real contagion. And in my clinic, we were able to overcome that. We were able to create a sanctuary. We were able to create a space where people who came to us were able to live free of fear and were able to carry that, like that bubble of protection back to their house. We were able to teach them. So when I started seeing what we were able to do for not just 1 month or 2 months, but for 2 years, we were able to do it in the day after day, night after night in the clinic. I started realizing that this was the fundamental problem for the world. So the book came out of that conversation, and about, I decided the first step was I needed to stop living my life where I was only dealing with one patient at a time. For 40 years, I have been doing that. And I said that from now on, I'm trying to go into try to take this message to a larger platform. I'm going to try to show people that you can live life fearlessly. You can live life powerfully. You can live life without getting bogged down by the circumstances that come your way. There is a way of living and being that is bigger than what life throws at you. Instead, you essentially craft the narrative of your life. So the first step in that was to write this book. And then after I wrote the book, got it published, I started talking about that book and using the book as a platform to take this message forward as to how are you going to do this? How are you going to live life powerfully? So I continue to be a physician, continue to do my work, but I also do this, like coming on podcasts like yours and speaking at events and so on and so forth, about telling people that there is a way that we are not small beings. We are actually very, very powerful beings. Human beings have immense power in them if they wake up, and that's all there is.
The million-dollar question, if they wake up. And like, it's a shame, because I mean, we've seen all over the world of people, you know, the fear that kicked in, that they didn't even want people to call to their house, and then they became isolated and depressed. It was a big chain reaction. Mm-hmm. And like, with like the World Health Organization now, or currently, I'm not sure, is it today or tomorrow, like where they're going to kind of have control over the next pandemics that they can be pushing and everything. I'm just curious on your thoughts on with them having full control.
Well, there is a part of, so the I go into that in the Reaper's Dance in chapter 6 about the whole idea of why did this pandemic have to be, why did we get it? And there is a conversation about the pandemic. The truth is, this pandemic, unfortunately, was not that natural as people would prefer it to believe that it was. And it is a conversation that is become very embarrassing for governments, because they unconsciously, without direct intent, they were instrumental in the creation of it. So, but bottom line was, there was a bunch of scientists, both on the US side and in the Chinese side, who were experimenting with bat viruses. And there is enough data right now. There is no longer in the realm of conspiracy. There is enough evidence. There are congressional reports and there are congressional memos. And even now there is a select committee for COVID pandemic that is still digging up more and more information about it. And several U.S. agencies have come out with the determination that this was probably a leak from the Wuhan Institute of Virology lab. The bottom line is, a bunch of labs and scientists in the U.S. were experimenting with a bat coronavirus that they isolated from a cave in Tongguan village in the Mojiang province in southern China. And this bat virus, which they isolated from that cave, already had the ability to bind to the human ACE receptor, but it was of low virulence. It was not capable of spreading wildfire. So they wanted to see, okay, this bat virus can already has the ability to bind. What would be the mechanism by which it would acquire the ability to jump. And they messed around with that, and they were, there is some evidence that they probably inserted something called a furin cleavage site into the sequence of the spike protein. And that furin cleavage site is not present normally in that subtype of bat coronavirus. The COVID-19 virus belongs to a species of coronavirus called the Sarbeco viruses. And it's a subspecies, it's a beta coronavirus. There's alpha, beta, delta, and gamma. So it's a beta coronavirus. And I don't want to get too deep into the scientific jargon, but bottom line, it normally that furin cleavage site is not present in the Sarbeco viruses. It is present in certain other type of coronaviruses. There are a lot of, there are almost 8,000 coronaviruses out there. So the problem, therefore, is that this is very unique, and it is only in the SARS-CoV-2, the COVID virus, that this furin cleavage site is there. There is enough evidence that several researchers from the Wuhan Institute of Virology fell sick in September, October of 2019. Well before, nearly 2.5 months before the Chinese admitted that there was their first case of COVID, there were three scientists from Wuhan who fell sick and got hospitalized. Around the same time as this happened, on September 12th, the Wuhan Institute of Virology had a public database of all the gene sequences of all the viruses that they had ever worked on. It was available to all the scientists of the world. This database suddenly went dark. It went silent. They took it off. It went offline. The Wuhan authorities said that they were doing a server upgrade. Then they changed that story to saying that their server crashed. Then they changed their story to saying that they were going to be hacked, so that they had to take it offline. To this date, September 12, 2019, that database was taken offline. To this date, that database has not come back into the public domain. It is operational now privately only for the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It is no longer available to the rest of the world. Around the same time as that database went offline, the administration of the Wuhan Institute of Virology changed from civilian control to military. A military general was sent in, and he took over as administrator of the institute. And at the same time, they brought in an outside contractor to do a $606 million upgrade of the ventilation and air conditioning system of the institute. So three researchers fall sick. The database of all the gene sequences of all your viruses suddenly become private. The military comes and takes over the institute, and you bring in, do a $606 million ventilation and air conditioning system, air handling system upgrade. You think it is not a leak? Come on. So people are not stupid. There's a lot of evidence about that. The problem was that all these researchers were using money that was funded by the US government. They had money from USAID, they had money from the NIH. So the US government was embarrassed by this. The Chinese government was embarrassed. And so they all shut it down. They shut down the conversation. They started putting pressure on everyone to say that it was a conspiracy. They put pressure on social media accounts to filter the conversation and do censorship. So that was the governments operate for the consolidation of power. Businesses operate for the consolidation of wealth. Scientists operate for the consolidation of publication power. So in the midst of governments wanting their power, pharmacies wanting wealth, and academics wanting papers, the average human beings and the wellness of human beings was forgotten. That is the story of the pandemic. That is the story of the Reaper's Dance. But that was the negative side. Other side of Reaper's Dance that other books on the pandemic don't talk about is, I wrote about ordinary people who came forward. Ordinary human beings came forward and connected people, saved people, life, made sure that people were safe and people were healed. It was simple, ordinary people, the janitors, postal workers, restaurant people, every mom and pop stores, physicians, nurses, ambulance workers, firemen, all these people came forward and saved humanity. That's all they did. While leaders were busy trying to protect their power.
And with all these gene editing labs, because obviously that's not the only one that's kind of, you know, experimenting on these things. I heard there's a lot in Ukraine, that they're all over the world. Like, what's, like, is that not fair, people? Why they do this? I understand if they're doing it to help a disease and stuff like that, stop transmission or something. But I mean, when they're creating things to hurt humanity, I know they're funded by the evil cabal and everything, but the reality is it hasn't stopped. I mean, there's still ones going on. And is there ways that people, like, we have to go for the individual? Like, what's in your thoughts? How do we kind of nip this in the bud?
I'm going to take a parallel from nuclear technology. So Hiroshima and Nagasaki produced 250,000 people died. Two explosions. And the nuclear Armageddon race was born. And to this day, we have that. But those two explosions of Hiroshima and Nagasaki also produced the Atomic Energy Commission. It produced checks and balances where nuclear work in any country in the world is regulated and overseen. I mean, people still do it, but there is power. There is, people can go in and say, you have to subject yourself to inspections. If you don't, we will shut your economy down. We'll put sanctions. We'll do this, we'll do that. You know, there are many accounts as to how many people died. Some people say 10 million, some people say 20 million, some people say 25 million in this pandemic. It doesn't matter. You know, 250,000 people died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and you have all the controls of nuclear research. You can't do nuclear research without proper regulatory oversight. Millions of people died here. And we still do not have the guardrails controlling this kind of research all over the world. There are 35 BSL 3 and 4 labs in the US. There are more labs being built all the time, all over the world. And there is no centralized oversight mechanism. So as long as it is not possible to tell people not to do this kind of work, people will continue to do this work. My belief is there needs to be guardrails. There needs to be very strict oversight. And there needs to be a central regulatory agency. I don't know what form it's going to take, whether it's WHO, or whether it's NATO, whether it's the UN. I don't know. There has to be, however, a central agency. And right now in the US, that kind of discussion is going on. In biosafety and biosecurity discussions are going on. There is now a realization that the NIH cannot be the auditor of these labs. There is an idea that there needs to be a separate agency, separate from the funding agencies, that will oversee with real regulatory enforcement capability, with real teeth, with the ability to go in and do search and seize, with ability for criminal punishment for violations. How this will evolve, it'll take time, but it has to be done, and it will be done. This is right now, it is very, very new and very, very, it is just now we are beginning this conversation. How it is going to happen, we don't know yet, but humanity is at a crossroads. We are no longer safe, and the next pandemic will happen. People will try to, it is just the curiosity of scientists that will drive them to go and mess with this. They'll just play with it because they can, because scientists by nature are curious. They want to dig, they want to find, they want to play with the cobra, they want to play with the dragon. They want to find out what makes a dragon lethal. The problem is not finding out. The problem is, can you shut the door behind you when you want to open it to the door of hell? Can you shut the door behind you? That is the real question. I don't have full answers to all of that, but these are questions that people have to answer.
Excellent. And with the people then that were, you know, getting sick, like, because there was so much ivermectin, lots of different things that people were saying were natural. But then I heard when people were going on the ventilator, Remdesivir, one of the guests that I've had on a few times, his daughter with Down syndrome was killed on that. And he was exposing all the stuff on the Remdesivir. I think it's called midazolam in the UK. And like, it was like they were intentionally trying to, you know, mercy killing, I don't know what you call it, but it didn't look like they were the right drugs to be used. Whereas there was some people getting fantastic success with natural things. And I just, with your experience on both sides, what was the best way of healing people?
So one of the things about the virus, the COVID virus, is that it creates a whole body inflammatory response. It drives the body's inflammatory mechanisms crazy. And this inflammatory reaction is the real reason that produced so much death and devastation. And one of the things between March 2020 and December 2020, it took us quite a long while before we were able to understand that people were really dying because of the inflammation. Once we understood that we had to cut this inflammation down, the initial pathway, so in March, April, it was all about Remdesivir, this antibody, the BAM monoclonal antibody, this trying to find what things work. One of the things that hydroxychloroquine has in its advantage is that it cuts down the inflammatory response. And that was one of the reasons why it has a partial benefit. It is not 100%, it is partial. Ivermectin has a slight effect, and that also is partial. The problem is that the people who were shutting down the conversation on these drugs were shutting it down as no, you cannot use it at all. It has no value, which is false. They have some limited value. The people who are saying no, it has value were also false. They were saying that it has immense value, which is does not. It has limited value. So in both sides of the equation, people were getting the fact wrong. The fact is ivermectin has a limited value. Hydroxychloroquine has a limited value. So therefore, the limited value was either wrongly shut down as zero or wrongly inflated as 100%. So that was the problem. That was one thing. The other thing is, when something has a limited value, like you have a small fire, let's say you have a small fire, a little candle is blowing, is catching fire there. One bucket of water will shut it down. A drug of limited value can, if you do it very early, you might be able to cut it down. All right? But if you wait for 4 days and the fire has consumed the entire kitchen, one bucket of water is no longer going to be helpful. Ivermectin is no longer going to be helpful. Hydroxychloroquine is no longer. So that is the tipping point. The tipping point is how do you give it early on and try to reduce your something small becoming bigger. That is one thing. The other problem is not everyone responded to ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. For example, someone who's young has a small exposure to the virus, starts it, gets better. Someone who is old and already sick with five other diseases has a small exposure to the virus, gets the same medicine, no effect because he's got other things that are making his response difficult. So this nuanced variation was not being understood by the average people. Everyone wanted their grandfather to get ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, but the grandfather is no longer is too old to get of any value from the medicine. So that same medicine did not have effect in certain people, but had effect in other people. This kind of variable messaging was not ever done. It was always black and white. It was always this or this. And that was the fundamental problem in the public health messaging during the pandemic all over the world. That everything was always black and white. The people on both sides of the fence were always black and white. There were no shades of gray. You are either this way or you are that way. And if you are either way, we are going to come and kill you. That is the whole point. So that is stupidity, in my opinion. Life is never black and white. It is always different variations are there. Now, prednisone became the life-saving drug during the second part of the first year, where in 2020, from August, September onwards, people began to recognize that if you had a sick person, you started giving them mega doses of prednisone, you could shut the inflammatory response down and you could save them. And people started combining these things later on towards October, November, and December. And then in December, the vaccine began to come out and immunity started developing and things started improving. But by then, the dialogue in the public health arena, the damage had already been done. The dialogue had become corrupted. People no longer believed what was right and what was wrong. People believed that everyone. So at various points, there was a loss of trust, right from the onset of the pandemic, the suppression of the cause of the pandemic. If there was honesty at that point, people would have believed something. And then the leaders of society also were mixing their messages back and forth. Mask, useful. No, mask is not useful. This way, that way. So at every point, there was the pandemic was the dance of two things. And that's why I call it the Reaper's Dance. One was the dance of the virus. The other was the dance of fear. And the third was the dance of deceit. So the dance of deceit, the dance of fear, and the dance of disease. These three things devastated the world.
So that's fascinating. And like with the jab then, because I mean, there's a lot coming out about that. My own personal experience, I didn't know anybody who actually had died of the COVID. I know people, friends of mine that did, but once people started getting vaccinated, I saw people, like a lot were dropping dead. And we've seen it in the news and everything, in like soccer players, all the sports stars, a lot of things. So like, I'd like to know your thoughts on the vaccine as well.
I don't know. I have not seen people dying of the vaccine. Personally, I'll tell you, because I have gotten the vaccine, all five shots. I got Pfizer first and second, then I got the booster, then I got the fourth booster, then I got the fifth. And I just got the fifth one in October this year. So, and to this day, I have never gotten the virus. So my other partner physician, we tested ourselves. So we wanted to test our antibody levels. So we wanted to see whether we had high levels of antibodies. So when you get the virus, you develop a different kind of antibody than when you get the vaccine. The vaccine teaches your body to make a different antibody than what the natural infection does. Because the natural infection, the virus, it hides the important part of itself. The virus fools the immune system into making antibodies that are not effective. It fools the immune system by showing a portion of itself that is not important for its own survival. And the human body makes antibodies against that useless part of it. And therefore, the immunity you get when you get infected is not robust. It is partial. It is not completely protective. On the other hand, the vaccine, they engineered it to show a very important part of the virus that normally the virus hides. And that means that the kind of antibody you develop when you get the vaccine is different in character than the kind of antibody you get when you get infected. So we tested ourselves to see what kind of antibody we had. And I, to this day, have only vaccine antibodies. I do not have the virus antibody, even though I have tested nearly 60,000 people and treated about 10% of them were positive. So when we test, we are at 6 inches away because I'm there in the nose doing it and they are coughing and sneezing upon me. So I, to this day, I have not gotten the virus ever. I don't have any, whereas my wife got it. My wife got it. My partner has both kinds of antibodies. He has the virus-related antibody and the vaccine-related antibody. That means he got the infected, even though he never really realized he was infected because he never really took a day off from work. So he probably got a mild exposure and he developed it and he then got over it. To this day, I have never gotten it. So all I can say is my experience. And my experience is I have not seen people get a vaccine and die. But I have seen two things. I have seen the vaccine. So remember, I told you that the virus has the ability to drive your immune system, the inflammatory response, crazy. And this inflammatory response, even after the virus goes away, sometimes continues for months on end. And that inflammatory response is what is the basis of long COVID. Some patients, when they get the vaccine, can get triggered in the same way as the virus itself. But does that mean that you should not take the vaccine? I don't believe so. I believe you should take the vaccine. Because it is like saying you can get hit by a car crossing the road, but does that mean you should never cross the road? What is the odds and how many people will have to cross the road before the first accident appears? So that is the same way it is with the vaccine. There is never going to be a 100% solution. So you're going to have to ask the question, what is your risk for disease and your risk for getting seriously injured by the disease versus what is your risk for getting the vaccine and the vaccine producing a damage to you versus what is the advantage of getting better? So it is always risk and benefit. If the benefit is greater than the risk, then take it. If the benefit is not greater than the risk, don't do it. My experience has been that the benefit exceeds the risk.
I mean, to be honest with you, my thoughts on this over the last few years have changed considerably, because I always just kind of went along what was told to us, got whatever jabs was, and like by actually investigating it myself and just reading a lot of literature from doctors as well. It's like even the VAERS report. I mean, they're saying that there's probably only 1% that's actually reported, and there's never been so many adverse conditions and side effects from the vaccine. No, then so like just on the scare.
I don't know about that, but I mean, obviously you are using data that I don't have, so I can only say what I can say. I have not seen that yet. If I see it, I'll change my opinion. But in my practice, I have not seen it. So
you know what I'd love to do, actually, because I've had a load of doc. I'd love to do a live call, because I love the way you're talking. I love the way you're actually sharing everything and how like even on the book and the fair factors and everything. Because you know a load of stuff you're saying is making sense. It's very good. So if you were up to it, I can get on one of the guys that's actually has access to all the various thing. And you got not an argumentative case, but just where you're both explaining your case, that so the public then can make an opinion based on two sides. Would you be up for that?
Sure, I don't mind doing that.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant. Yeah, so I'll organize that. So yeah, brilliant. Yeah. Listen, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I'm looking forward to actually getting the book, because you know, the information that you shared. So you might let people know, Dr. Ivor, where they can contact you.
Oh, my website is www.driyer.com, driyer.com. I can just let me put that in the chat.
I have all the links, so I'll make sure in the show notes. Okay. I'll include the audio and the video.
Okay, so it's www.driyer.com. And you can pretty much find all the things I do, the books I write. I'm writing my second book on neurodiversity right now. And my work on the speeches I do and things like that, the research I do, my clinic in Northern Virginia, the Ayer Clinic, where we see patients and do our everyday work. All of that is available in that one location. So that's the easiest way. Anybody who wants to email me can email me, and I always respond. So that is the best way. The book itself, you get it on Amazon. Just do the Reaper's Dance, REAPERSDANCE, or my name, RAVIIYER, on Amazon, the search bar. It'll pop up, and it's an easy read. Most people who have read the book have enjoyed it. The reviews are really good. So I'm, of course, you know, I'm the author, so I'm going to say good things about the book. But apart from that, I also feel a sense of responsibility about it. I do believe that the book is well written, and I do believe that people will enjoy it when they read it. I don't pull any punches in the book. I speak, I say what it is. I give credit to certain people that people don't give credit to. For example, I give credit to Trump for the Operation Warp Speed. I also call him out for some of the stuff that he did that was not helpful. So I say things like the way it is, the way I see it. I let people come to their own decisions. That's fine.
Perfect. No. Listen, thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I put all the links, even the book, on both the audio and the video. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, that's all for the Speaking Podcast. Until next week, you'll find everything on speakingpodcast.com. Thank you. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Be sure to give us a thumbs up, 5-star rating, and share with your friends. And you'll find all my shows with the QR code or bio.link/podcaster, as well as my podcast coaching. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, danielpacker.com, helping people with anxiety, stress, and addictions. He's got a 90% success rate, and you only pay if you're successful. Also, if you'd like to go on a podcasting tour, I can help you do that. And if you're interested in sponsorship, you can contact me on my bio.link/podcaster. Until next week, take care.